Part 2, 1795 to 1814. Chapter 5, A New Era Commences. Thus we left the scene of my early life and started on this then hazardous journey and perilous enterprise. We had with us our four children. Ephraim Cutler, June 15, 1795. 1. Young Ephraim Cutler and his father were much alike in a number of ways. Both were vigorous, affable, well-intentioned. Both were devoted family men with a strong allegiance to their Puritan values. At approximately 6 feet in height, Ephraim stood a bit taller than his father and was, as said in the family, more strongly built and quite handsome, with dark gray eyes. But Ephraim's childhood had been altogether different from that of the other Cutler children, and he was different as a result. He had been named for a younger brother of his father's, who had been thrown from a horse and killed the year before Ephraim was born. At age 3, on a visit to the Cutler grandparents at their farm in Killingly, Connecticut, they had, as he later wrote, earnestly entreated that I should remain with them, and in some measure supply the place of the son of whom they had been so unexpectedly bereaved. And so he had been left to their care, and there he was to stay. Only once, when his father was ordained, was he taken by his grandfather to visit Ipswich Hamlet. His parents came to see him, but he did not go again to Massachusetts to see them until he was 16. Instead, he grew up knowing firsthand the ceaseless hard work of a farm. If he harbored any resentment that he had been passed off to his grandparents, and thus denied the childhood provided his brothers and sisters by their parents, he is not known ever to have said as much. Though it had been his grandfather's intention that he be educated at Yale, as his father had, the troubled economic state of the country following the Revolution made that impracticable. He had, as he said, a strong propensity to read, and thus gained a good understanding of history and geography quite early. By age 16, because of his grandfather's advancing age, he had had to take charge of the whole business of the farm, which included cutting and hauling wood, driving sheep and cattle to market, and once driving a rafter of turkeys about 24 miles to Providence. The Cutler farm was spread across a high hilltop with a sweeping view of the western horizon and memorable skies at sunset. What influence, if any, the presence of such a panorama may have had on the attraction of the West to both Manasseh and Ephraim, no one can say for certain, but it could have been considerable. At the urging of the pastor of the church in Killingly, the Reverend Elisha Atkins, Ephraim studied on his own mathematics and surveying, which were to prove important to him. But he knew that was not enough. "It has always been to me a source of regret," he later wrote, "that I was deprived of a liberal education." Try as he would, he could never master proper spelling or punctuation, a deficiency his father was to call to his attention all too often. In 1787, the year of his father's success with the Northwest Ordinance, and the year his younger brother Jervis set off with the first pioneers to leave for Ohio, Ephraim, "before I had attained my 20th year," as he said, married Leah Atwood of Killingly, and in the years that followed, with a young family to support, he struggled to succeed with several enterprises that failed, and felt himself ever more ready to join the move west. Jervis, meanwhile, had given up in an attempt at farming near Marietta, sold his land, returned home to New England, and was married in 1794. He wished to go back to Ohio, he told Ephraim. "I should esteem it one of the greatest pleasures of my life," he wrote. But his wife feared the dangers and privations of pioneer life. Reports on the situation in Ohio, while rarely providing much in detail or with consistent accuracy, were in reasonably good supply in the Philadelphia, New York, and Boston newspapers. Most likely, Ephraim turned to the Massachusetts spy for the latest word from beyond the mountains in accounts dateline Pittsburgh. And by the end of August 1794, like everyone in the East, he knew General Wayne's victory. On the 15th of June, 1795, all necessary arrangements completed. Ephraim and his wife said goodbye to old friends and departed for Ohio. Leah had been in poor health, and many who pressed around her on parting expressed their fears that she might not survive the journey. She answered cheerfully, saying she had committed herself to God and should not suffer herself to be disheartened, and especially since several physicians had advised a change of climate. With them were their four children, ages 7 through 1, 2 horses, and 1 cow to provide an abundance of milk on the way. Their conveyance was a wagon drawn by a yoke of oxen. Also traveling with them were a number of Putnams of all ages, part of the family of the famous, highly colorful Revolutionary War general, Israel Putnam, with 2 large wagons, 4 oxen, 4 horses, and 3 cows. Ephraim, of course, knew a great deal about Ohio and a number of those with whom his father had long been associated, and Rufus Putnam in particular. But he did not yet know Rufus Putnam or anyone else at Marietta. Nor did he have any clear idea of what he might do once there, or what opportunities might arise. The journey as far as the mountains of western Pennsylvania went without difficulty. Beyond there, the road was no better than it had long been, and the struggle, mile after mile, was no less than ever. On reaching the Monongahela River, Ephraim had a boat built, and on this the party proceeded past Pittsburgh and onto the Ohio, where the current carried them steadily on downstream at about 3 miles per hour. Somewhere short of Beaver Creek, tragedy struck. The Cutler's youngest child, 1-year-old Hezekiah, took ill and died. A halt was made at a single cabin by the shore, where the owner had already buried some of his family, and there Hezekiah was laid to rest. Again we moved on in the usual slow way, the river very low, Ephraim wrote. Below Wheeling, we saw but few openings on the banks, no one living for 50 miles. For all that had been written and said about the thousands pouring into Virginia and Kentucky, no sign of that was to be seen. All was an unbroken wilderness. Then, after leaving Wheeling, the Cutler's oldest child, Mary, age 7, became violently ill with bilious fever, and she, too, quickly died. She had been her father's favorite, and her death was a blow such as he had never known. To add to our distress, he wrote, we had no alternative but to commit her to the earth in the dreary wilderness. Nothing could be worse, he recorded. Their sufferings were by no means over. Farther on, Leah Cutler, while stepping down a plank to get on shore, slipped and fell and suffered 2 broken ribs. About the same time, Ephraim was struck by an attack of dysentery and much weakened before landing at Marietta, the morning of September 18th, fully 3 months after leaving home. As he would write, it was a bleak beginning. We had landed sick among strangers, with no well-known friend to meet us with kindly greeting, and myself destined to be confined to a bed, from which, for a time, there seemed little hope that I should ever rise in health. Such was our introduction to pioneer life. Where or with whom the Cutlers stayed their first days after landing is not clear, but their response to the setting, as it had so often been for so many others, was one of wholehearted approval. There is probably no more beautiful and pleasant location to be found on the banks of the Ohio River, wrote Ephraim, who cited as well a number of principal inhabitants whom he had already met, including Rufus Putnam, Ebenezer Sproat, Paul Fearing, and Dr. Jabez True. He also went on to describe how the years of Indian troubles and the ways of those confined to garrison life had brought a change in the established way of life. How, as he was told, it had broken up former fixed habits of industry and led to a fondness for sports and social meetings where drinking was practiced and hours spent in jovial conviviality. But there appeared to be little need for excessive concern. Those New Englanders who first settled there had come with habits of industry, respect for order, and strict subordination to law, and clearly that outlook still prevailed. Indeed, it would be difficult, Ephraim had already concluded, to collect a more intelligent and refined society than could be found at Marietta. Ephraim made his first visit to Waterford, 20 miles up the Muskingum, soon after recovering his health. Several of the Waterford settlers, who were also from Killingly, came with a canoe and took him back up the Muskingum. Once there, he decided Waterford was the place to locate. One particularly generous man, a Revolutionary War veteran, Captain Daniel Davis, offered Ephraim and his family half of his home, which Ephraim estimated to be the best log house in that part of the wilderness, in which to spend the winter. Waterford by then consisted of 32 families spread along the east side of the Muskingum, and once settled, the Cutler family found themselves, even with the onset of winter, far more comfortable than they had been at Marietta. To Ephraim's great surprise, the weather proved quite mild. His team of horses found employment, plowing unfrozen ground through the entire season. In addition, Rufus Putnam hired him to work surveying some 50,000 acres of land there at Waterford, mostly east of the river, and the $100 he received in payment proved a great relief to me in my then needy circumstances. That spring, he moved his family into an empty cabin near Fort Fry and purchased 4 acres of rich bottomland. On his own, he managed to clear it of its giant beech and poplar trees, which to a green hand, as he acknowledged, was a severe labor, as the condition of his hands bore witness. The corn he planted produced a fine crop, and that summer he built a cabin. By fall, he and the family had moved in. That the son of Manasseh Cutler had come to Ohio and brought his family with him, and that he so clearly had come to stay, did much to lift the spirits of the earliest of the settlers. Now, before the year was out, he received a thick packet, which on opening was found to contain 3 commissions from Governor St. Clair, one as captain of the militia, another as justice of the peace, and another as judge of the first Court of Common Pleas. His astonishment was overwhelming. He felt himself inadequate to fulfill the duties involved, and until Dean Tyler, the same scholarly Harvard graduate who had been of help to Ichabod Nye when he first arrived, observed that though it was most likely the appointments had been made owing mainly to his father's character, he ought not hesitate in accepting them. And so he did. When he left New England to head west, Ephraim had expected that most likely he would make farming his way of life and was encouraged to do so by his father. The more he saw now of the lands to the north of Marietta, the more convinced he became that his initial plan had been the right one, and again he was encouraged by his father. "I have earnestly wished you to have a good farm, to establish, if possible, a good landed interest in preference to trade or any other object," Manasseh Cutler advised in a long letter. "For there is nothing in this country that will render a man so completely independent and secure against the difficulties which arise from the changes which the times, the state of the country, and other contingencies may occasion, and which are, and always will be, taking place in the world. Human life is short and uncertain," he continued. "The sooner such a work is undertaken, the better." In 1797, 2 years after his arrival, Ephraim purchased 600 acres, some 20 miles into the wilderness northwest of Marietta. By selling 100 acres each to two other men, along with a gift to each of an additional 100 acres, he set out with them to commence a new settlement. But not until early 1799, because of various circumstances, did the clearing of land get underway. With 1 acre cleared, a log cabin went up, and on May 7th, Cutler, his wife and children, who by then numbered 3, made the 20-mile trek through the forest with loaded pack horses to take up residence in their new home. With the help of the two other men, who with their families had established their own cabins, Ephraim set about preparing more ground for planting. The timber was large, principally beech and sugar tree, all of which we cut down and piled, and burned the most of it, he would later recall. 4 acres were cleared, ready to plant by the 15th of June. From this patch of ground, I raised that year 150 bushels of corn that ripened well. The wilderness to the north and west was a favorite hunting ground of the natives, which in the hunting season they still occupied in large numbers. They sometimes visited us, Ephraim wrote, but did us little injury, except stealing 2 horses. Buffalo and elk were still to be seen. Deer and bears were abundant, wild turkey innumerable. Wolves and panthers also infested the woods. From the Cutler cabin to those of the other pioneer families was a mile or two. On June 17th, 1799, the day after finishing the planting, Ephraim made his way back through the woods to Marietta to attend court. Starting then, he was to be called away to serve as a judge 4 times a year and had to spend 2 weeks or more each time. Court sessions were customarily held at Campus Martius, but also quite often at a considerable distance from Marietta in what was still wilderness, areas in which one of the court's most difficult duties was to prevent illegal occupations by newcomers. As said in one account, in those early times, notwithstanding the primitive state of society, the judges had proper ideas of the sanctity of law and the dignity of a court. At the trial of one land case, at which Ephraim and another judge named Alvin Bingham presided, the leaders of the disorderly class came forward and threatened violence. The magistrates ordered them to leave the room, which they did, but uttering threats to put a stop to such courts. In the words of one old account, the judges, determined to vindicate their judicial dignity, instantly issued warrants and ordered the sheriff to arrest the parties immediately and take them to Marietta. They were arrested accordingly, and it is not easy to conceive of men more frightened. The idea of being taken to Marietta to be tried by a court that had established a reputation throughout the territory for firmness and strict justice, filled them with terror. Judge Bingham's brother, Silas Bingham, a deputy sheriff and a man known for great shrewdness and dispatch in the role, as well as unconquerable humor, did nothing to ease their fears, but told them a better way would be to come into court and get down on their knees and ask for forgiveness and promise amendment. The ringleader of the offending party replied, "It was too bad to be compelled to kneel down and ask forgiveness of 2 Buckeye justices, but he concluded to submit rather than be taken to Marietta." The judges received no per diem or travel expenses. In all the years Ephraim served in the Court of Common Pleas, he did not receive a cent. Often, coming and going, he had to camp in the wilderness, yet he never failed attending a single session. 2. By the autumn of 1795, by dint of hard work and consistently high performance over the years since he first arrived at Marietta, Joseph Barker, at age 30, had achieved notable importance. He was a man of many interests and skills, an independent thinker who read widely. Moreover, he was a happy man, much liked by everyone, and blessed with a family now numbering 3 children. In 1792, he had spent the better part of the year building a new blockhouse at the Point. The year after, hoping to avoid smallpox, he had moved with his family downriver to Belpre, where, part of the time, he taught school. Then, in February 1795, for his services during the Indian Wars, he received a grant of 100 acres 7 miles up the Muskingum at what was called Wise Man's Bottom. That spring, with the help of his 2 brothers-in-law, he began clearing 2 acres of giant black walnut and sugar maples, planted an apple orchard, the whole time feeling compelled, as he put it, to hold his scalp on with one hand while he dug holes for the trees with the other. By December, he had also completed a 16-by-16-foot log cabin. 1 week before Christmas, he and his family established themselves on the farm that was to be their home for nearly half a century. As would be said, the fortitude and perseverance requisite to meet the hardships and privations of a settlement in the wilderness were found centered in this family. Barker's wife, Elizabeth, too, was credited with all the patience, resolution, and good sense needed in no small degree. Their nearest neighbors were 7 miles away, back in Marietta. In the year that followed, 3 more families, including that of Captain Jonathan Duval, moved to Wise Man's Bottom. Barker cleared more land, enlarged his orchard with 200 peach trees, and put up a larger hewed log house with a brick chimney, a refinement rarely attained by pioneers before the passing of several years. He also helped develop a salt spring on the other side of the Muskingum. Clearly, he had achieved success in ways he had never imagined. At home, the Barker children were being raised, as one daughter, Catherine, would remember, to be useful, to be pleasant with our playmates, respectful to superiors, just to all, black or white, good to the poor, not showing pride or selfishness, but kindness and goodwill, and to see to it that we look to our own more than to others' faults. She would also, much of her life, like to quote words to the wise that were most frequently repeated by her mother, and that could have served for the motto of most of the community. Count the day lost at which the setting sun sees at its close no worthy action done. But as with so many on the frontier, life was not without its worries and blows. Catherine would also recall, "I sometimes thought it terrible to live in the woods and hear tell of snakes and wolves and panthers, and when I went to the spring, was afraid I should see some of them." One of the Barker children, a boy named William, drowned in the Muskingum River at age 3. When fire destroyed the first log cabin Barker had built, which he had since converted into a workshop and storage place for the great stock of tools he had brought from New England, all of which were destroyed, along with a quantity of food, he went back to work as both carpenter and builder. As it was, the demand for such skills as he had mastered had grown greater than ever. With the Indian War ended, Marietta had sprung back to life. The revival of river traffic, an abundance of food supplies, trade goods, and a steady flow of new emigrants, families in quest of a new life, had resumed almost instantaneously. Marietta was growing and prospering once again. A new post office was established, and a first school, Muskingum Academy, under the leadership of Rufus Putnam. A first school building, a modest frame house, went up on Front Street. A first courthouse was built on the corner of 2nd and Putnam Streets and stood 2 stories high with walls 3 feet thick made of hewn yellow poplar logs. Log cabins were being replaced by more comfortable houses with glass windows. A visitor from Massachusetts only a few years later would note in his journal that Marietta had 91 dwelling houses, 65 of which are frame or plank, 11 of brick, and 3 of stone. Much work went on, and the demand for such skills as Barker, the master builder, offered, only grew greater. Indeed, he had so pursued his interest in and study of architecture by this time, and perfected his skills, that he could rightly be called the first architect in the Northwest Territory, and was to design and build homes for the Reverend Daniel Story, the lawyer Paul Fearing, and others. But a magnificent mansion, a structure like nothing else to be seen anywhere along the whole length of the Ohio River, would upstage everything Barker or anyone else had accomplished until then, and would remain the subject of much talk for a long time to come, as would its owners. Harmon Blennerhassett and his wife Margaret were like no other couple yet to appear on the Ohio frontier. No one dressed as they did, or conversed so readily on so many subjects, or spent so much money so lavishly, or appeared so entirely out of place. Both were new to America. He was of Irish aristocracy, a graduate of Trinity College in Dublin, an heir to a fortune. She was 7 years younger than he, English, and though of limited means, well-educated, well-read, and as cultured as her husband. That she was also his niece had played a significant part in their decision to depart for America, where they would be less likely to be ostracized for so scandalous a marriage, and particularly in the new territory of the remote West. They arrived in Marietta in the fall of 1797 and began looking about. After seeing a beautiful island 12 miles below the mouth of the Muskingum, opposite Belpre, an island that was part of Virginia and near land once owned by George Washington, Blennerhassett decided it was the place for him. For the upper portion of the island, a stretch of some 169 acres, he paid an unprecedented sum of $4,500 to the then owner, Elijah Backus, the brother of Lucy Backus Woodbridge. He then proceeded to have much of the ground cleared for buildings and gardens. Meantime, the couple moved in to live temporarily in an old abandoned blockhouse on the property, which was where their first child, a boy, was born. In no time, they became a most conspicuous element locally, a twosome such as had not been seen before or even imagined. He was a tall, thin, gangling man, prematurely gray-haired and slightly stooped. He dressed in the old English style, with scarlet or buff-colored breeches and silver-buckled shoes. Severely nearsighted, he could read only by putting his face so close to a book that his rather large nose nearly touched the page. He was also highly intellectual, fond of experimenting in chemistry and electricity, a classic scholar, an accomplished violinist. As soon became apparent, he was as well quite eccentric, absent-minded, a touch snobbish, and easily rattled. On the approach of a thunderstorm, he would close all the doors and windows and huddle in the middle of a bed to avoid the accidental effects of the electric fluid. Then, too, notably, he was not always sensible about how he spent his money, and thus was easily duped by some of the locals known for dishonesty. In the days before limestone quarries were opened, river clamshells were calcined on log fires and used to plaster rooms. In bargaining with one noted cheat, Blennerhassett was told that collecting the shells was a difficult task, in that it was necessary to dive into water 6 or 8 feet deep, and therefore the charge was 50 cents a bushel, when in truth, any quantity of shells could be found in water only inches deep. Blennerhassett paid 5 times what the shells were worth. Among those he dealt with locally, he was known, half in affection, half ridiculed, as Blanny. Margaret, however, drew even more attention, and particularly as she appeared far more often in public. Though not beautiful, Her neck was a bit too long, her mouth a bit too small. She was tall and stately, a young woman, as said, of the most perfect proportions, her eyes dark blue, sparkling with life and intelligence. She rode a white horse superbly, and on frequent excursions to Marietta, sported a scarlet dress with brass buttons and a white beaver hat festooned with white ostrich feathers, and she moved fast. Fluent in French, she was also known for reading Shakespeare aloud with all the vitality of a great actor. At home, she often wore a bright yellow or pink silk turban. It should be added that her money sense was no better than her husband's, and the fact that she was his niece was not to become known for several years. Because their island, Blennerhassett Island, as it was known, was part of Virginia, 8 black slaves were purchased to serve as cooks, waiter, grooms, and to operate ferry service back and forth to the island. This last, most important position was filled by a young black man, Mackejah Phillips, known as Cajo, who had been taught to read and write by Margaret Blennerhassett. The total outlay for the house and improvements of the grounds, which featured an extensive English garden laid out and tended by an English gardener named Peter Taylor, would come to an unheard of $50,000, or perhaps more. It was clear nothing was to be spared in the way of expenses, and that once completed, their home would far exceed in size and elegance any structure to be seen the length of the Ohio Valley. In such a wilderness setting, it seemed at first sight totally incongruous and unreal, as did its owners, who, in a land where everyone worked exceedingly hard of necessity, did nothing but whatever suited their pleasures. To no one's surprise, the builder chosen for the task was Joseph Barker, who drew up the plans for the house and would be credited, then and later, as the architect, though doubtless others, too, including Blennerhassett, would have been involved in the design. Barker laid down substantial boat landings for a sizable workforce, and the volume of stone, lumber, and other supplies needed, no small task in itself. The house was to be of Palladian design, with a large 2.5-story wood frame main section, from which were to extend 2 portico wings, curved like arms reaching out, at the ends of which were to be 2 other buildings, or dependencies. The main house, with its 10 rooms, would measure 39 by 54 feet and contain fully 7,000 square feet, while the dependencies, though small by contrast, were each 26 by 26 feet, or about the size of the average Ohio cabin. The building at the end of the left wing was to be the summer kitchen and servants' quarters, that on the right, Harmon Blennerhassett's study. Pressure was on to finish as soon as possible, the Blennerhassetts having no wish to wait any longer than necessary to take up residence in their dream palace. As it was, the work went on for 2 years, and given the scale, the quality, the attention to detail achieved, that too was remarkable. Meanwhile, giant crate loads of exquisite mirrors and massive furniture, much of it from abroad or custom-made in the East, kept arriving. In good weather, the numbers of visitors to the site grew steadily. Everything about the finished interior was done to perfection, with the finest of woods and craftsmanship, from its domed entrance hall to the great dining room and banquet table, to the downstairs drawing room, which, with its polished black walnut paneling floor to ceiling, was considered the finest room of all. Shining brass doorknobs, gold moldings, marbled wallpaper, a giant Venetian window, and well-stocked library upstairs were all further evidence of elegance of the kind one might find only in England or Europe. Yet, there it stood on the Ohio frontier. One of the many visitors was to describe the house and gardens as a scene of enchantment, a Western paradise, where beauty, wealth, and happiness had found a home. Others were to call it the Enchanted Island, an earthly paradise. The house had cost a fortune. And most happy was the Blennerhassett family, by now increased by 2 children, when they took up residence. Parties were put on for young people from Marietta and Belpre, and extended social gatherings for the older, more sedate portions of the community, invited to spend several days and nights on the island. Guests came by canoe or rowboat, or most often by the Blennerhassett's own ferry service, operated by the ever-cordial Cajo. In the summer, when the river was low, many came on horseback. Ephraim Cutler was among those who came in social contact with the Blennerhassetts, and in later years liked to talk about Mrs. Blennerhassett, describing how she could ride the wildest horses. But he had also known her to walk from her Ohio River landing to Marietta and back in the same day, a distance of 24 miles. The way of life, the privacy and pleasures of convivial society that Harmon and Margaret Blennerhassett had hoped to attain in their wilderness paradise, would continue for several years, largely as they had envisioned. Neither they or anyone else imagining what was to come, and that they were, as said, to figure prominently under the spotlight of history. With startling suddenness, just at the close of the 18th century, death had come to George Washington. A heavy cold had turned suddenly to pneumonia, and after the struggle of 24 hours, he died at his home at Mount Vernon on December 14th, 1799. He was 67 years old. His last words were said to have been, "'Tis well." The nation, said President Adams in a formal message to Congress, had lost her most esteemed, beloved, and admired citizen. I feel myself alone, bereaved of my last brother. In Marietta, among the many veterans who had served under Washington during the war, the feeling was much the same. With a new century underway, the times were changing nearly everywhere, including Marietta, where a promising new enterprise was taking hold. In 1800, a merchant named Charles Green had a 110-ton brig built there on the riverbank by Stephen Duval, an ocean-going square rigger christened St. Clair, which set sail down the Ohio at the end of April 1801, when the river was at its ideal springtime height. In command was Commodore Abraham Whipple, the famous Revolutionary War naval officer and a new resident of Marietta. It was to be a commercial voyage to New Orleans, then on to Havana and Philadelphia. Along the entire length of the Ohio, from Pittsburgh to the Mississippi, there was only one difficult, even dangerous stretch, and that was the Falls, or Rapids, at a bend in the river at Louisville, Kentucky. There, a ledge of rocks extended across the river over a distance of about 2 miles, and the river cascaded down in whitewater rapids some 26 feet. When the river was high, the fall was made apparent only by the increased speed of the vessel. If the river was low, the rocks came into plain view and the passage became quite dangerous. There was a choice of 3 channels. One on the north side, called the Indian Chute, was the main channel. Another, the Middle Chute, was considered safe and easy in all heights of the water above middle stage. The third, on the south side, called the Kentucky Chute, was passable only with the water high. Under the right conditions, the falls could be passed without great difficulty by canoes, flatboats, and keelboats. There were also experienced pilots regularly on hand to conduct boat traffic over the rapids. But how well a square rigger the size of the St. Clair might do was a subject of much speculation. As it turned out, Commodore Whipple, with his abilities as a seaman, negotiated the challenge himself in his own way and with perfect success. He went over the falls backwards, stern first, dragging two anchors from his bow to keep to the center of the channel and control the descent. He then sailed downstream and on to the Mississippi, to New Orleans, and out to sea. At Wise Man's Bottom on the Muskingum, Joseph Barker's friend and neighbor, Jonathan Duval, had started building a ship of 400 tons for a Marietta merchant named Gilman, the entire vessel made of the black walnut that grew in such abundance along the river. The year following, Duval built two more ships, brigs of 200 tons, and Barker, too, established his own shipyard on his farm by the Muskingum, and in 1802 built two ships on order, one a brig for Harmon Blennerhassett, the other a schooner for Edward White Tupper. The orders for these ships had come through an active young Marietta merchant, Dudley Woodbridge Jr., the son of Lucy Backus and Dudley Woodbridge Sr., who had become something of a business partner with Blennerhassett and had worked with Barker in supplying materials needed for the building of the Blennerhassett mansion. In a letter to his father dated March 18, 1802, Ephraim Cutler wrote, "I am fully convinced that this is by far the most eligible place to build ships within the United States. At any rate, there are 10 vessels of from 1 to 300 tons burden to be built here this summer." On the evening of May 4, 1803, the brig Mary Avery of 130 tons, built at Marietta, set sail and, like other vessels built at Marietta, provided a spectacle for the people of the town, who saluted with cheers on the shoreline and small cannon fired. Serious shipbuilding on the Ohio, a dream long held, had become a reality, and the reach of Joseph Barker's involvement and influence in the community had increased still more, along with his circle of friends, among whom now were the Cutlers. One of the Barker daughters, Catherine, would later write at length of the Cutlers as a family highly respected for their moral worth and standing, and of her own particular affection for one of the Cutler daughters, Sarah, who became a cherished friend. The Barker family, too, had expanded by now to number 9 children, and Barker had decided it was time for a larger home of his design, work on which was to go on for several years. Built on higher ground, farther back from the Muskingum, it was to be a large brick house in the Federal style, with a handsome front door flanked by recessed side windows and an elliptical fanlight overhead. 2 large windows to either side of the front door had 24 panes, 12 over 12, each, as did the windows above on the second floor, which were also recessed in brick arches, an architectural touch that was to distinguish most of the buildings designed by Barker. Once completed, the whole house was painted white and soon became, as intended, a distinguished seat of hospitality. 3. The year 1800 had been one of unprecedented political turmoil at the national level, with the Federalist president, John Adams, challenged for re-election by the Republican, or Democratic, candidate, Thomas Jefferson, who proved the victor. Then, too, in 1800, and to his immense surprise, the Reverend Manasseh Cutler, at age 58, was elected to Congress as a Federalist. As he explained in a letter to Ephraim, when the previous representative had announced only that November that he no longer wished to serve, the principal leaders of the towns around had held a meeting and decided he should be the nominee. "It was so sudden, and to me undesirable, that I wished to decline," Manasseh confided to his son. "I conceived myself that there was no probability I should be elected, but the event proved very different from my expectations. As he would also report, he won every town by large majorities, but added that he viewed it as very unpleasant business. Thus, Manasseh Cutler, Doctor of Divinity, Doctor of Law, Doctor of Medicine, had become Congressman Cutler, and since his town had lately been renamed, he was Congressman Cutler from Hamilton, Massachusetts. He departed Hamilton for Washington early the next year, and that same year, 1801, Ephraim II entered politics for the first time at 34, elected as a delegate from Washington County to Ohio's territorial legislature. Ames, the settlement Ephraim had started on Federal Creek, could now claim, as he proudly reported to his father, a population of 161 souls. He himself had never been so involved with the community, in addition to his own enterprises. He also continued buying and selling land, and profitably, all this much to his father's approval, it would seem. Yet the elder Cutler could not help but lodge his fatherly disapproval of certain of his son's failings, almost as if Ephraim were still a boy. In the same letter, in which he reported to Ephraim his election to Congress, he concluded as follows: "I cannot close this letter without suggesting some little inaccuracies in your letters, which I wish you to attend to and which you must necessarily correct. I find in almost every one of your letters you begin on the wrong side of the sheet of paper. Look at my letters. You will find every letter is begun on the side of the sheet with the fold to the left hand. You will observe the same in every letter you receive from any man who knows anything of letter writing. Your spelling is also bad. If you have no English dictionary, I wish you by all means to receive one. Good composition looks ill if it is badly spelt. By looking your words up in a dictionary as you write, you will soon spell right." His punctuation was also not what it should be, the father went on. His question marks sometimes appeared where there were no questions. It was as if the eminent master of his rectory school were lecturing one of his slower students. In response, Ephraim wrote to his father, "I thank you for your advice respecting my pointing, punctuation, writing, etc. I will attend to it as much as in my power. But till lately, it was rare that I took a pen in hand to write, except to you. And I write so bad a hand, and am so unacquainted with grammar, that I feel so ashamed of my performances in this way that I almost wish a letter burnt as soon as was written." During his time in Washington, Manasseh was to write often to Ephraim and other members of the family, describing what he was seeing and people he was meeting. To his surprise, he found the city far more appealing than expected, the weather remarkably pleasant, as he wrote to his daughter Betsy. "The block in which I live contains 6 houses, 4 stories high, and very handsomely furnished. It is situated east of the Capitol, the highest ground in the city. Mr. Nathan Reed and myself have, I think, the pleasantest room in the house, or in the whole city. It is in the 3rd story, commanding a delightful prospect of the Capitol, of the President's House, Georgetown, all the houses in the city, a long extent of the river, and the city of Alexandria." Only the Capitol was a disappointment. He thought it a huge pile, very heavy in its appearance without, and not very pleasant within. The President's House, on the other hand, was both well-proportioned and pleasingly situated. The house in which he lodged was owned by a couple named King, whose very handsome 17-year-old daughter, Anna, played the piano with great skill. 2 or 3 evenings a week, he and the other lodgers would gather to hear her perform. As he wrote to Betsy, "After we have been fatigued with the harangues of the Congressional Hall in the day, and conversing on politics in different circles, for we talk about nothing else. In the evening, an hour of this music is truly delightful. For his fellow lodgers, all members of Congress, he had only praise. Three were from Connecticut and fellow Yale graduates. John Davenport was a very pleasant, agreeable man. John Cotton Smith, the son of a clergyman, and a man of very sprightly and distinguished talents. And Elias Perkins, a man of very handsome abilities. As for Nathan Reed, Manasseh's roommate, a Harvard graduate, who was also from Massachusetts, he could hardly say enough. Were I to have made my choice among all the members of Congress for one to have lived in the same chamber with me, all things considered, I should have chosen Mr. Reed. Like Manasseh, Reed, too, had great interest in science. Remarkably, all these gentlemen were professors of religion and members of churches. An unbecoming word is never uttered by one of them, and the most perfect harmony and friendliness pervades the family. As usual, Manasseh was to keep an extensive diary in which he recorded the ups and downs of Congress, days of very little done, days of debates long, warm, and acrimonious, days of nothing very interesting. Besides, as did few others, he recounted occasional added experiences of particular interest, such as a visit to Mount Vernon made with a small delegation of fellow representatives to have breakfast with Martha Washington. She appeared much older than when he had last seen her in Philadelphia, but she conversed with great ease and familiarity, and appeared as much rejoiced at receiving our visit as if we had been her nearest connections. We were all Federalists, which evidently gave her particular pleasure. She spoke of the general with great affection, viewing herself as left alone, her life protracted to the point where she felt a stranger in a strange world. She repeatedly remarked on the blessings bestowed on her. But as Manasseh also recorded, she talked of the election of Jefferson, whom she considered one of the most detestable of mankind, and the greatest misfortune our country had ever experienced. To this, Cutler added that such unfriendly feelings toward Jefferson were to be expected, given the abuse Jefferson had directed to General Washington, while living, and to his memory since, though what exactly Cutler had in mind, he did not say. Several weeks later, with a number of others, he was a guest for dinner at the president's house and afterward recorded only that Jefferson was social, then went on to describe all that was served in some detail. Indeed, his diary entry would be the only known record of the full menu of one of the many famously sumptuous Jefferson banquets. Rice soup, round of beef, turkey, mutton, ham, loin of veal, cutlets of mutton or veal, fried eggs, fried beef, a pie called macaroni, which appeared to be a rich crust with the strillions of onions or shallots, which I took it to be, tasted very strong and not agreeable. Mr. Meriwether Lewis told me there were none in it. It was an Italian dish, and what appeared like onions was made of flour and butter, with a particularly strong liquor mixed with them. Ice cream, very good. Crust, wholly dried, crumbled into thin flakes, a dish somewhat like a pudding. Inside, white as milk or curd, very porous and light, covered with cream sauce. Very fine. Many other gimcracks, a great variety of fruit, plenty of wines, and good. All was going better for Manasseh than he had expected. Before I came, he confided to Ephraim, I was apprehensive that as I was a clergyman, I might meet with some unpleasant things on that account. I viewed myself a speckled bird, because I presumed I should be viewed so by others. But the case has been far otherwise. President Jefferson paid him more particular attention, he believed, than any one Federalist in either the House or Senate. From members of Congress, I have received every civility I could desire, not with our own party only, but I often converse freely with those of the opposite side, and in the most cordial manner. As for the work itself, he had to say it was trying indeed. In early spring of 1802, Ephraim made the long journey from Ohio to Washington to spend some time with his father, though exactly why neither was to say. Their first day, they enjoyed a spring stroll together down the shores of the Potomac as far as Alexandria, dined there in a public house, rambled a bit around the town, then took a boat back to Washington. In the days that followed, Manasseh wrote of the weather, of attending committee meetings, but said nothing of consequence until May 4th. But even then, he recorded only, "At 5 o'clock, took leave of my son, Ephraim, who set off for the western country." Of their conversations, of issues on their minds, political or personal, he said not a word. Nor would Ephraim. But almost certainly, a great deal of what was said was taken up with Ephraim's new role in Ohio politics now that the new Ohio legislature was underway. With Ephraim no longer keeping him company in the daily tedium of so much of the congressional life, Manasseh began writing ever longer letters home to his wife, Mary, urging her to write to him more often. So greatly did he miss her. In another month or two, the evening of the same day he received a letter from her, he writes, "I rejoice to hear you are well." Then went on again at length about much that he faced in Washington. In still another letter, he was beside himself in an effort to express his longing for her. "Your very affectionate letter of the 6th has touched my heart and excited the most tender sensations. The sincerest love has always rendered a long absence from you extremely irksome and painful. Be assured, my dearest love, my kind and affectionate wife, that I now anticipate with anxious expectation, if it may please heaven, the day when I shall have the pleasure of seeing you again, and then we may converse on subjects which I do not wish to commit to paper." 4. By order of Congress, the town of Chillicothe, about 100 miles west of Marietta on the Scioto River, had become the capital of the Northwest Territory in 1800. Ephraim Cutler, a new member of the legislature, had been appointed to a committee to create a road from Marietta to Chillicothe, and with the help of Rufus Putnam, he had spent 2 weeks plotting a route through the woods. At first, the new territorial legislature commenced its sessions in a 2-story log house that also served as a popular tavern. 2 years later, the legislature relocated to what was reputed to be the first public building built of stone in the Northwest Territory. It was there, during an Ohio State Constitutional Convention convened in November 1802, that the 2 delegates from Washington County, Rufus Putnam and Ephraim Cutler, both new to politics, stood firm on an issue of utmost importance that they, like others, had thought long since settled, the question of slavery in Ohio. In the election selecting Rufus Putnam and Ephraim Cutler as delegates to the convention, a black servant of Colonel Israel Putnam, Christopher Malbone, also known as Kit Putnam, was permitted to cast his ballot in the district of Marietta. It was considered to have been the first vote cast by a free black African in the Northwest Territory. The political picture at home in Marietta had greatly changed, just as in so much of the country since Jefferson's victory over John Adams. The time when Revolutionary War veterans, nearly all staunch Federalists, had control in Marietta had passed. Jefferson Republicans were claiming predominance. The whole makeup and nature of political rivalry had changed, and as Ephraim wrote to his father, and no doubt discussed with him during their time together in Washington, there was cause for serious concern. Political parades and gatherings were filled now, as Ephraim wrote, with dirty, drunken, newly imported Irishmen, some quarreling, others singing the praises of their leaders. A scene worthy of the attention of a Hogarth, he thought. The immediate issue at Chillicothe centered around what was to be Article 8 of a new constitution, and a first preliminary discussion of the matter took place at the home of a Dr. Edward Tiffin, a resident of Chillicothe and a Jeffersonian, who was Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives. The subject was the question of whether Ohio permit or exclude slavery. Immediately, the chairman of the committee, John W. Brown, proposed a section that would define the issue quite simply. No person shall be held in slavery, if a male, after he is 35 years of age, or a female, after 25 years of age. In other words, the tenet of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, stating in no uncertain terms that there would be no slavery, was to be eliminated. Slaves would be permitted in Ohio up to certain ages, which meant Ohio was to be a slave state. To Ephraim, there was no mystery as to who was behind the move. The handwriting, I had no doubt, was Mr. Jefferson's. Another member of the committee, Thomas Worthington, a Virginian by background, told Ephraim that Jefferson had confided to him that he hoped such an article would be introduced into the Ohio Convention, and that he hoped there would be no further effort made for the exclusion of slavery from the state. Ephraim at once spoke up to say that those who had elected him to represent them were very desirous to have this matter clearly understood and to avoid any excessive warmth of feeling. He moved to have the matter tabled until the next meeting, and he hoped very much each member of the committee would prepare a statement clearly expressing his views. The following day, Ephraim made the case for his position, that there must be no slavery, as strongly as he could, and at some length. And when the issue came to a vote by the committee, the Jeffersonian version, as he called it, met with fewer friends than he expected. For some time, he had not been feeling right, but the day after, the day when the issue was to be voted on by the committee of the whole convention, he had become quite ill. The nature of his ailment is not clear, but he had little or no strength to get out of bed. Then Rufus Putnam came to his room and exclaimed, "Cutler, you must get well. Be in your place, or you will lose your favorite measure." According to one account, Putnam and another man carried him to the convention on a stretcher, but there is no reliable evidence of this. Cutler himself wrote only, "I went to the convention and moved to strike out the obnoxious matter, and made my objections as forcibly as I was able." It was an act of wholehearted fortitude, and the result was never to be forgotten. "It cost me every effort I was capable of making," he wrote, "and it passed by a majority of one vote only." Fully 15 years after his father's success in championing passage of the 1787 Northwest Ordinance, abolishing slavery in the territory, he had carried the same banner of abolition, and with success. It was a landmark moment, as would be written in time to come. To Ephraim Cutler, more than to any other man, posterity is indebted for shutting and barring the doors against the introduction into Ohio of the monstrous system of African slavery. Nor was Ephraim's opposition to slavery ever to fade. Partly for speculation, and partly to encourage settlers to come to Ohio, Ephraim had purchased a considerable amount of land from proprietors in New England on credit, and which he sold to new settlers on credit, then waited on them until they could raise cattle to pay him. No fewer than 200 families were thus furnished with farms. This had led him into the droving business, which meant driving a herd of 80 or more cattle back over the mountains of Pennsylvania to markets in the East, no small or easy task. As he would explain, there was no other means of raising funds to pay my debts, and it resulted in placing many poor families who had nothing to buy land within very flourishing circumstances. The first such drive occurred in 1800 and was the first ever out of Ohio, and he kept at it annually for 30 years. These trips over the mountains were attended with much anxiety and fatigue, wrote his daughter Julia. Sometimes he realized a profit upon his cattle. Perhaps as often, a loss was experienced. For some years, the roads over the mountains were infested by men of desperate character who laid in wait for drovers, and many robberies were committed, and several murders perpetrated by them. From these dangers, father, although several times placed in circumstances of known peril, was mercifully preserved. It was on such a drive a few years after his vote on slavery that Ephraim crossed paths with a party of slave drivers and masters, with two or three droves of Negroes. And as he wrote, he gave one of the drivers and the master who rode in a carriage a lecture they will be likely to remember, adding, too, that he felt better for it. I felt some energy, and what little humility I possess was roused at this shocking sight. Another of the noblest of those objectives, championed by the original pioneers, including most prominently Manasseh Cutler and Rufus Putnam, was higher education. In January 1795, at a meeting held in Marietta, the directors of the Ohio Company determined that two townships be reserved for the creation of a university, and that a surveying party under Rufus Putnam and a guard of some 15 men set off on the Hocking River to determine the site. Manasseh Cutler would write, "This was a strange introduction of the higher classics to the Northwest. In a fleet of canoes, propelled by the power of the setting pole against the swift and narrow channel of the Great Hocking, accompanied by armed guards against the lurking savages, and carrying with them the pork, beans, and hardtack that made up their rough fare, the committee of old veterans of three wars proceeded to fix, with compass and chain, the boundaries of the university lands. There was little of culture and polish in the undertaking, but rifles, canoes, and salt pork were never put to a better use." And in this same cause now, Ephraim and Rufus Putnam took the lead at Chillicothe in the signing of a charter to establish a state university at the location first surveyed on a series of hills overlooking the Hocking River. With the same brightly optimistic spirit that had inspired Putnam and others to call Marietta a city, the little college town that was to emerge in the wilderness by the Hocking would be called Athens. And while it was Manasseh Cutler's idea to name the new institution the American University, the name chosen was Ohio University. But there was still more to be done in the cause for learning. From Athens to the settlement Ephraim had helped establish at Ames was approximately 7 miles. And there in Ames, at about this same time, as Ephraim would write, the intellectual wants of the neighborhood became the subject of much conversation. And so it was decided to establish a public library there in the wilderness that would become famous as the Coonskin Library. A library society of some 25 members was organized, each of whom was assessed $2.50. The first name on the list and first librarian was Ephraim, and the library was to be located in his house. To cover the cost of the books, it was decided to collect raccoon skins, and proceeds from the sales of these back in Boston made possible the purchase of some 50 choice books, selected appropriately by Manasseh Cutler. Life for the Cutlers on their Federal Creek farm, meantime, had changed greatly. In November 1801, Ephraim's brother Jervis had appeared on the scene once again, and in the month following, their younger brother Charles, too, arrived and moved in with the family. Charles was 29, a Harvard graduate and schoolteacher, and he had come to take the place of the one previous teacher in the Ames community who had proven unacceptably intemperate. Charles had long suffered from poor health, and so had headed west also in the hope of benefiting from a change in climate. But Charles also, it seems, was an alcoholic, and had long been a worry back home. Details of his troubles during his time with Ephraim and the family are few, but tragically, 3 years later, Charles died there at age 32. The sorrow felt was great indeed, and particularly by his father, because of the great Western adventure he had helped set in motion. Two of his grandchildren were buried on the banks of the Ohio River. Now, one of his own children was gone. It is painful indeed to reflect that he should fall a victim of his own imprudence, Manasseh Cutler wrote to Ephraim on receiving the news. It is not possible for me to express the distress and anxiety of my mind for him, nor the extreme disappointment, after I had struggled with almost insurmountable difficulties to get him through college, that the prospects that which early opened for usefulness and respectability should prove abortive. But the will of God is done. Brother Jervis, by contrast, seems to have taken hold quickly and in impressive fashion, having hired a shop in Marietta and set himself up in the tinning business. He is in great spirits and has the reputation of an uncommon industry, Ephraim was pleased to report to their father. In another year or so, he had branched out to an active fur trade in Chillicothe. The momentum of change seemed only to increase all the while, and there was no question that the hand of Jefferson, in Ephraim's expression, brought it on. He had removed and replaced Arthur St. Clair as governor, a move long overdue. At age 68, St. Clair was in poor health and often out of touch. On a recent visit to Chillicothe, he had gotten quite drunk. He would retire to his properties in Ligonier, Pennsylvania, where he was to die impoverished and living in a log cabin. Jefferson also removed Rufus Putnam from the office of Surveyor General of the United States, a position to which President Washington had commissioned him. As Ephraim would write, no man in the territory more entirely deserved and enjoyed the respect and confidence of the people than General Rufus Putnam. The Ohio legislature completed a state constitution, and it was carried to Washington, to Jefferson, who sent it on to Congress, where it was approved by both the Senate and House. It was then returned to the President, who signed it into law, and thus, on February 19, 1803, Ohio became the 17th state of the Union and the first state established in the Northwest Territory. Later, in 1803, on an infinitely grander scale, Jefferson brought about great historic change with the purchase by the United States from France of the vast Louisiana Territory west of the Mississippi. Further, he commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, both experienced soldiers, to explore what had now suddenly become the new and far vaster Northwest Territory. On the evening of September 13th, the reality of this was brought home to Marietta, when Meriwether Lewis and his crew, on their way down the Ohio, stopped there to lay over for the night. But as everyone in town was soon to learn, their progress was delayed several hours the next morning, when it was discovered that two of the crew had gone ashore during the night and gotten so drunk they were of no use. With the pull of the West growing greater than ever, the number and variety of those appearing on the scene at Marietta on their journeys on the Ohio was bound only to increase. Among the great many who were altogether inconspicuous was a family from Leominster, Massachusetts, not far from Rutland, Rufus Putnam's hometown. Their name was Chapman, and they took up frontier life in Washington County, in a log cabin on Duck Creek, 15 miles north of Marietta, and 7 miles from the nearest neighbor. They were there to stay, except for one eccentric 30-year-old son named John, who would not remain anywhere for long and was to become famous as Johnny Appleseed. Like Rufus Putnam, he had a great lifelong love of apple trees and had committed himself to supplying settlers with apple seeds or young trees, while at the same time he spread the gospel according to the Swedish theologian Emanuel Swedenborg. Much would be written and said about Johnny Appleseed, including much that had little or no bearing on the truth. But as for his appearance, there is no doubt. It was described as outlandish even on the frontier. He was quick and restless in his motions and conversation. His beard and hair were long and dark, and his eyes black and sparkling. He lived the roughest life and often slept in the woods. His clothing was mostly old, being generally given to him in exchange for apple trees. He went barefooted and often traveled miles through the snow in that way. He was welcome everywhere among the settlers and was treated with great kindness even by the Indians. His wanderings, almost entirely in Ohio, were to go on for more than 40 years. The legend would last far longer.